Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. What is this week?
Happy almost August.
It is almost August. Oh, happy Bayham's Army is 2-0
week. There you go. Happy birthday, Sean Keeley.
Happy birthday, Sean Keeley, which is going to be, what, 2 or 3 days ago by the time this gets posted?
I mean, hopefully it's yesterday.
Yes, hopefully it's yesterday. And I will say that, you know, it's taken so long for Tom McPherson to get the Heisman Trophy recognition that he deserves. So I think Sean will still appreciate one day late birthday appreciation.
I saw his birthday present today was he got a follow from Charlie Loeb.
Is that not the customary?
What do you get for someone that has everything?
apparently I saw that. Apparently Charlie is coaching quarterbacks at St. Anselm, Anselm.
Which we have a lot of experience with at SU for some reason.
Do we?
Yeah, I believe Lester or somebody else in the old staff was there. I think that somebody on the current staff might have been there at some point. I think Lustig might have been there.
Was a offensive line coach from under Schaefer, whose name's escaping me. Was he there?
That sounds about right. Adam?
Yes.
Joe Adam? Joe Adam might have been there, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't remember if there was any overlap. I don't think so, because I think Loeb was done in 2013-ish.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there was overlap there. But yeah, definitely interesting connection. Good for him.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Joe Adam was at St. Anselm. Anselm's a weird word, I've learned, in this last, like, minute.
It's not even a word.
It's a weird name. It's, like, a hard... because I'm like, trained to say A-S and not A-N. It's just a weird combination of letters. I don't like it.
I buy that. Ban Anselm. See, I can't even say anything.
Anselm.
Yeah, we're out of here.
I don't like it.
This is the worst opening ever. Anyway, bullet number one. John and Dan try to pronounce a word for 5 minutes.
An obscure, I'm guessing, D3 school name from Massachusetts.
Yeah. As we mentioned, Boeheim's Army is 2-0. They're in the Northeast bracket. They're headed down to Atlanta to face Armored Athlete. First and foremost, Armored Athlete is the number 4 team in this bracket. They're also 2-0. They looked really good in the first round, a little bit closer in the second. They're pretty stacked, to be honest. I mean, Boeheim's Army played well in the first couple of rounds, but also kind of messed around a little bit too much. And that works against lesser teams. It's not going to work against, you know, a group of players with guys from Oregon and Purdue, Rhode Island, Indiana, Louisville, West Virginia, Ole Miss, Miami, Holy Cross. Like, there's a lot of guys on this team, and while they might not have the continuity that Boeheim's Army definitely, you know, benefits from, they do just have the raw talent and a lot of guys. I mean, not really much, if any, NBA experience, but some G League experience, a bunch of experience playing abroad. So these guys are pretty talented nonetheless.
Yeah, it's not totally unlike the last team we just faced, which whose name is escaping me.
Team Fancy.
Team Fancy, which had a smattering of players you probably recognize as a college basketball fan. This team is largely the same. You've got probably more talent, I'd say. You have Jordan Hulls and Will Sheehy, who were both at Indiana for a while. I think they were both on that Indiana team that we beat.
They were.
In the NCAA tournament in 2013. Kevin Jones, who was a very good player for West Virginia. Preston Knowles, who was at Louisville, who we obviously played. Stephen Moody, who was the best player at Ole Miss for a while, a couple of years ago. I'm going down the list here. Marcus Thornton, who was at William & Mary, but I feel like he was somewhere else before that, right?
No, that's the other Marcus Thornton.
Okay. Okay, I was thinking of former net Marcus.
Yes,
Thornton.
That Marcus Thornton went to LSU. I did the same thing last night, and then I like and then I started like looking around. Some of the fun
Terrica
facts.
White, who was at Ole Miss, so like yeah, that's a lot of pretty high end D1 talent.
Yeah. So some of the two fun facts I named in the article that I did for the preview today was the Marcus Thornton mention that we just had.
He actually looks like the other Marcus Thornton too, which throws me off.
Yeah,
he looks like him, and I think they're like listed around the same like.
They went to school around the same time.
Yeah, like they, I'm looking at regular Marcus Thornton. I mean, the best way to describe it. former NBA player Marcus Thornton, who is a 6'4" shooting guard. This Marcus Thornton is a 6'3" guard.
Thornton prime.
Right. Both have facial hair. The mix-up's understandable.
Totally is, yeah. The other Marcus Thornton played for the Wizards in 2017. That was his last NBA stop.
He played for the Kings and the Nets for a while, and he was one of those guys who would, like, barely play for a week at a time, and then he would drop, like, 25 out of nowhere.
Yeah, and would also, like, be a trade kicker, like, randomly.
Yes, he was probably traded about 5 times.
As I recall. The other fun fact I mentioned, Armored Athlete players are 6-9 all-time against Syracuse.
Nice.
Unfortunately, all 6 belong to Preston Knowles.
That makes sense.
That makes...
I'm surprised Tevin Jones didn't get one.
He was on from 08 to 12, and that included a 5-game losing streak.
I was going to say, was he too late? But no, that's actually really funny, because, like, those were really good West Virginia teams.
Those were also really good Syracuse teams.
Yeah.
There was really that one... You remember that one in there? It was 2011, where we almost effed it up?
If you gave me more details, I would.
It was like a late... I don't remember exactly what happened. Like, we had a lead, and then we, like, almost messed it up with some free throws. It was... I think it was 2011. Like, where we, like, got by... We got out of there by, like, the skin of our teeth, if I recall correctly.
I believe you, because it sounds like a very plausible Syracuse
I remember team. I was watching the game at brunch and pissing off my friends and my wife. I told them, just don't schedule things for when I'm, like, you know, gonna have
okay, yeah, we actually came back.
Ah, that's right.
I found the game. We won 63-52, but it was, like, way closer than that. I'm looking at the bot store now. Yeah, apparently we were down...
Oh, wait, no, that's not the game I was talking about. I was talking about the 2012 game, apparently. That's the game.
Okay.
The 63-61 win.
Okay.
Where a lot of dumb things happen that I can't necessarily remember at this point.
You know what I enjoy, though, is that when you Google 2012 Syracuse, West Virginia, you get the Pinstripe Bowl. So that's definitely was not one that we almost gave up. We won that one pretty decisively. 63-61 game. Let's see, do I remember this one? Kevin Jones scored 20 in that game, which is, I guess, relevant. And Brandon Trish scored 18. He actually scored 20 in the one the year before. Yeah. So Brandon Trish apparently was good against West Virginia. Who knew?
Yeah. Yeah, but the other players, Jordan Halls went 0-1. Will Sheehy went 0-2. Demetrius Conger was 0-1 against... It was 0-1 with the Bonnies. Jones was 0-5. And then you get to Preston Knowles and his 6-0 record from 2007 to 2011.
Yep.
I never saw them beat Pitt or Louisville the entire time I was at SU.
I think I finally saw us beat Louisville maybe my last year. Maybe the my last year was the Elite Eight team. I can't remember, though. But I've obviously Pitt and Louisville were our only regular season losses in the 2010 year, and they just dominated. Those were the two teams. And now, actually, it's funny that, like, after the ACC move, obviously Louisville's been, you know, had its craziness. Pitt's obviously struggled. Syracuse hasn't been great the whole time, but has had the two deep tournament runs. But also, our luck has really shifted against those two teams.
And most teams, really. Even in the ACC, UNC is the only team that we're really, like, significantly under or over 500 against.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, even, like, BC, obviously, has had those weird wins against us.
Well, I think them were, like, 8-4. That sounds right.
Yeah, but that's not, like, crazy. No. That's not, like, what we did to, like, West Virginia in this streak, or even, like, Marquette for a long time just could not beat us to save their lives, despite being, you know, a very good team. So, Big East, we definitely had these, like, weirder things where, like, there were the two teams we could not beat, and then there were, like, a handful of teams, even really good ones, that just could not touch us for some reason.
It was very strange. So, for this game, I'm concerned about the shooters for them. I'm concerned about the fact that Tariqo White pretty much did whatever the hell he wanted the last couple games. Scored a combined 44 points. Went 6 of 11 in the opener from 3. Obviously, Demetrius Nichols shot pretty well from 3 previously. I know John Gillen shot really well. Nonetheless, like, he's going to be somebody to watch and somebody to really be concerned about. Julian Gamble, who played for Miami, had a double-double this past game, as did Murphy Holloway. You can't hone in on one guy here, and you know, I think for Syracuse that's the case as well. which should be an equal challenge for both teams. But I am kind of concerned that, you know, this this team of Syracuse alums could fall for the same reasons that a typical and scholarship Syracuse team would fall.
Yeah, I think the thing that we've noted through these last couple of years of the Boeheim's Army runs is that they do tend to play like Syracuse, which I guess makes sense, but you wouldn't necessarily think they would, like, you'd fall back into old habits. But it's definitely the case. The one thing I will say, looking at the box score from last game, they really ran their five guys out there. There were five guys that played over 21 minutes, and everyone else was in single digits, including Moody, who was a really good player in the SEC. He might have even been SEC Player of the Year his senior year. And then John Octeas, who was a pretty... He was at Purdue, I think?
Yes.
I guess he finished at Colorado State. But yeah, both those guys even played under 10 minutes a game. So I do wonder if that was I don't know if they've like just worked with the rest of the team less or what the deal is, but they had much more of a defined five-player rotation with a couple other guys sprinkled in versus some of these other teams that definitely balance things out more.
I mean, even us, it's weird. Like, you know, Ryan Blackwell's not Jim Boeheim, but his rotations look pretty similar. You know, if you do look at the previous Boeheim's Army box score, six players played 22 minutes or more, and then you had another three, Chris Joseph, James Sutherland, and Deshaunte Riley, pick up the rear for a combined 29 minutes. Riley had zero shots. Sutherland was only one of three. Like, this is what I don't get. And I don't put this on the coaching staff. I just think, like, Joseph and Sutherland seem like guys who can score, but really didn't get much of an opportunity to do it. Trish was cold from the floor. Everybody else was all right, to be honest. Like, the low score would make you think that everybody was pretty ice cold. But, like, I mean, Onuwaku got a lot of chances inside and only converted 4 of 11. And then, yeah, like, that 1 for 8 from Trish, really. Like, those two, I think, lines kind of tell the story. Everybody else shot about 500 or better from the floor as far as, like, the six standard rotation guys.
Yeah, it feels like we are kind of riding the hot hand, and Chris hasn't really gotten it going yet. Sutherland is a little surprising because he, you know, was such a big factor last season, and right. He really hasn't gotten it going. He was 1 for 8 in the first game. But obviously then you have, like, John Dillon, you just can't take off the floor based on how he's playing. He's been the best player on the team, which is probably not something that we would have projected.
Not at all.
I know he had some moments last year for sure, but, like, he's just been so far and away the best player on the team, and was, you know, unbelievable in game one, and then helped ice game two down the stretch along with Nichols, big clutch three. So that's nice, like, considering Gillen, like, you know, he had obviously some huge moments in his 1 year at Syracuse, but, you know, then there were other games where he couldn't really even get on the floor because of matchup issues or because of defensive issues. And I tweeted something like, it's cool to see, like, some of these guys who, you know, maybe didn't get these full fleshed Syracuse legacies. Even Deshaunte Riley had, you know, some huge moments in the TBT last year, and he transferred away after 2 years from Syracuse. It really allows them to kind of add a little bit something to it, because clearly the Syracuse fan base is taking this, you know, and we've talked about it, like, taking it more seriously than
the
vast majority. Yes, which I don't expect anything less. And, like, we joked about it heading in, and then, like, obviously I was on the edge of my seat the first game until we broke things open, and the second game as well. So it's definitely cool to see guys like that mixed up with, like, guys like Warwick, who were, you know, haven't been at the school for however long, which is, you know, depressing to think of because of the amount of time we've waited since that last national championship. But, you know, he has been around for, what, now 12 years, I guess, since he graduated. So that's one of the really cool things here. But you do hope that you get, especially Joseph and Sutherland, with their scoring ability, you hope they get them going because they should be, on paper, two of the more well-rounded scorers and well-equipped for this tournament on the team.
Yeah, I mean, they should be well-equipped. I think, like, you look at the size advantage that we have with guys like Warwick and Onuwaku and Riley. Like, even Sutherland's a little bit bigger. He's 6'8". Like, we should have a size advantage against most of these teams, and I think we definitely had a size advantage against Team Fancy. I do hope that they can get Onuwaku going because I feel like, you know, we talked about it before the tournament started. Like, that, to me, definitely seemed like our biggest plus was having somebody that could really man the middle on both ends. You know, if Gale Nation had been able to advance against Armored Athlete, I would have felt really great, if only because, you know, they really are a smaller team. They trotted out four guards last game against Armored Athlete. Armored Athlete has some size in there. Holloway, Gamble, like, they put, again, both put up double-digit rebounds. So, you know, guys to watch. And then Tariqo White also had 9 rebounds himself. Like, I do think that Onuwaku is going to be the key here. Like, he hasn't really broken a game open just yet. If he can sink more of those shots, collect a couple more boards, I think that, you know, he becomes such a difference maker because he is one of the bigger players left in the field.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. It will be interesting to see if we can get him going. He is kind of a different player in this tournament. You know, we haven't seen too many, like, true low post presences like him really make a huge impact. But it feels like he should be able to. The one concern for me is the refereeing has been very shoddy.
Yeah.
I guess that's, you know, what you get in, like, a pro-am tournament like this, but it's been very questionable. He's only 2 for 6 from the line so far through 2 games. But even just, like, getting calls down there can be, like, difficult just because, you know, I think these kind of refs are going to be more, I imagine they'd be more concerned about not making, like, the game a total foul slog fest, especially when you have a tournament that is including the Elam ending, where the whole, like, deal is to avoid, like, crazy foul shooting contests. So hopefully, if we do kind of pound it inside, he's, you know, obviously him at the line's an adventure, but hopefully he's at least getting there if he's actually getting fouled.
100%. So for you, like, how do you see this matchup playing out? Do you think that they just have too many shooters? Do you think it's really going to rely on Onuwaku? Do you think that we just have to wait and see if one of these other shooters on the SU bench can get hot? Like I mentioned at the start, like, I am a little nervous about this game, and maybe it's just a style of play thing from the first couple games where we were really kind of playing bully ball. I would like us to push the pace a little bit here because I think that's the only way you're going to be able to beat, you know, Armored Athlete given the scores they've been able to put up so far.
Yeah, I'm definitely concerned. I mean, they have the talent. They have a nice complement of shooters. We didn't face them last year, did we?
We did not.
No, we faced another team that was very similar, where it was like a collection of like college names you'd know. Even Team Fancy was like kind of like that, but not as deep. I think having 2 games under our belt will help, just for the chemistry. Like, obviously they have their little like week long camp, but I feel like this team we saw last year got a lot better during the tournament, even as the competition ramped up. So hopefully that's the case once again. And we just have seen so many, like Sutherland and Joseph especially, and even Devendorf hasn't been, you know, super on his offensive game. It's really been the Dylan show with some nickels as well. I just think this roster has so much more to offer that as long as we unlock at least a couple more of these guys, then, you know, we'll really see what this team can do versus, you know, what was a really grind in round 2 and even through in round 1. The first 3 quarters, this team didn't really show up to play super well. It was just that fourth quarter that was so impressive. So and the one thing I will say is it's impressive that Blackwell has seemed to he seems to really know what he's doing with his Elam ending. We saw him take the time out to make sure that he was getting the best possible scenario to get to the 7 points for to get the extra 7 points. The team's getting to the line, even though that's supposed to you know, designed to kind of prevent that. The team's attacking and forcing the defense to make mistakes down the stretch. So I think he's really coached to this new style of the end game pretty well, which helps because I think I haven't seen a ton of the other games, but I've read a couple other instances where the coaches haven't been as equipped.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, obviously, if you change some of the rules of the game, if somebody's not ready to adjust, it can definitely cause problems. So I do commend Blackwell for being able to do that. Switching focus a little bit before we get to halftime, I did want to talk about the ACC Network. There was a little bit of talk about it over at the ACC football kickoff last week. They were just discussing, you know, some Labor Day games, and Syracuse might be involved there against Pitt next year. Wouldn't be the feature game, obviously. And then maybe moving some basketball games to a kind of like, you know, in-conference tip-off situation where like Duke would be removed because they always have the Champions Classic, whatever the hell that thing is, that they play in, but then everybody else, you know, would kind of play like a game just to kick things off and start off, like, you know, with the conference game. A lot of those games, if not all of them, would end up on ACC Network. It would drive subscriptions. It would drive interest in the network. That all seems interesting. But to me, I think the bigger issue here is the overall dynamic of cord cutting and the changes with, you know, over-the-top programming and streaming and how that's becoming the prevailing notion of where people are going, and yet this ACC network is supposedly going to be focused on linear. I find the timing odd, and I find the any talk of an $8 to $10 million range per school for revenues from this thing to be largely overblown.
Yeah, it's the one thing I will say, which is I'm going to be optimistic about it. Especially compared to some of the things we've heard about the concerns of the Big Ten Network, which I think Dan Wetzel raised recently.
Yep.
Coming off their media days, where there could be, you know, a dip in I mean, there's the whole Comcast issue where they might lose a lot of their coverage, which makes the whole Maryland Rutgers thing kind of look funny if that's the case in those areas. But we'll see. I know ESPN has had its own issues with cable cutting. The thing is, I would much rather be tied to ESPN than tied to, like, the Fox.
Yes, 100%.
The Fox conglomerate. I think ESPN's going to survive. Now, they might not be the total behemoth that they were in, like, the mid-2000s, but ESPN's not going anywhere. And they're not going to just punt on the ACC network after, like, a bad year. Like, I think the ACC network's going to be something for the long haul. It's just the partnership there is too strong. It's too important. So, I did appreciate your article. I think they definitely need to think past, like, what we've seen from these networks generally. I think SEC Network's probably a little more fully flushed out because they have, like, the documentary series, and they have Feinbaum, who they nailed down ahead of Media Days, which is important. I think kind of developing some similar stuff for the ACC is important, but also not just, like, relying on old games. Because while those have some, like, some fun kitsch, I think you definitely need something a little bit more dynamic, especially as we move into this, you know, digital, more digitally focused era, where there's going to be more of a push for original content and stuff that people are actually going to want to watch versus just, like, having it to have it. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with it. The ACC obviously doesn't have the brand recognition as the SEC or the Big Ten, and probably not the level of diehard fandom across the board. But I also think it's probably going to be I imagine it's going to cost less. I mean, we know Syracuse is so heavily involved, and there's going to be a lot of student-run stuff. But hopefully it allows ESPN to, like, be a little forward-thinking, because I think overall, like, the ACC is not going anywhere, so I think it kind of opens them up to take some risks and try some new things as well.
Oh, yeah, and to be honest, like, I think the ACC network is going to be there. I just think it's a question of whether how successful it can be and how much carriage it can get outside of the Mid-Atlantic area. I'm not even expanding that out, to be honest. Like, I'd say from Florida to Virginia, they're good. And then past there, like, that's where the problems start, especially for, you know, like, whether it's New York or, like, there's a lot of carrier issues that get introduced. I mean, who knows what happens with, you saw what's happened with the Pac-12. Like, no, they haven't been bled dry by not being on DirecTV, but it certainly hasn't helped. I mean, you're looking at well over 20 million households there that they still haven't been able to get into, and now they might not get into it all ever based on kind of the issues they're having with AT&T and DirecTV. To me, I do think that, yeah, the unique programming and rolling the dice a little bit is the only way you're going to be able to get carriage, not just viewers. Like, Big Ten Network and SEC Network have carriage, but you look at what they're able to do with that and getting in front of people, and it's not necessarily that great. I mean, the Big Ten has some really nice spikes in terms of TV impressions around football games, but beyond that, like, not a whole lot of people are watching, you know, during the holidays, not a whole lot of people are watching during the early parts of the basketball season until you get to tournament time. And then even then, like, the only spikes were really, and this is all based on data that I've seen, the only spikes that were kind of created were around, you know, some of the men's basketball tournament games that were tossed on there. And then after that, like, it's all kind of dead period. For the SEC network, those viewer numbers really weren't, at least for, you know, just in terms of raw impressions, weren't really even close to what the Big Ten was putting up for those big games. And the SEC actually was getting more bang out of, you know, those basketball games, because, you know, Big Ten fans, as much as, you know, it, you can overgeneralize, you know, the Southeast, you can overgeneralize the Midwest as much as you want. There's a lot bigger cities, you know, in the Big Ten, and there's a lot larger carriage, and there's a lot larger alumni bases in large cities for the Big Ten. So for them, you are seeing this sort of, like, you can put Penn State, Ohio State on Big Ten Network, and people are going to watch and figure it out. Down the Southeast and down the Southeastern Conference, like, you can't put Alabama Auburn on SEC Network. People would lose their goddamn minds, and half the fan base, hell, half of the SEC's fan base collectively either wouldn't have it or wouldn't even know how to get to it, and would you know, burn down the local Piggly Wiggly as a result. So I think that they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place there, and I'm curious to see how that develops for them. But I'm curious to see too the kind of type of lessons that teaches, you know, the ACC and ESPN as they're going through this endeavor with a year out.
Yeah, I will say one of the advantages that the ACC does have in that regard is that it, I would imagine, I think someone did a study a couple of years ago. I'm going to assume the ACC still has the largest footprint in terms of population.
They do.
Yeah. So now I don't know that necessarily means that the ACC network is going to be automatically in all of those spots. But if it does, if ESPN does a nice job of getting it on everywhere, I know there were some issues with the SEC network before launch, if I remember correctly. If the ACC network will be available to a lot of people. Now, you know, getting people to tune in is a whole different issue, especially as cable cutting becomes more of a thing and fewer people are going to be paying those fees. So we'll see how it goes. At the end of the day, I feel way more comfortable being partnered with ESPN than not being partnered with ESPN on this, because I don't think they'll let it just fail. It might not be like a resounding success, but I think it will be something, and something is better than the RSN situation.
Ugh. Yeah, that was one of my big you know, pieces of focus in that article today. It was talking about, like, unique content and using the digital community around the ACC, you know, one that was kind of birthed by the realignment scare and everything else. Like, we do have a lot of fun collectively as a group with the nonsense that goes around the ACC, both the good and bad, you know, whether it's people like Ben Swain or ourselves or Lauren Brownlow. Like, there's a lot of people that have a lot of fun with ACC content online, and, like, no, it doesn't mean that the ACC network and ESPN should be hiring all those people, but there are a lot of easy ways to get those folks involved, and you know, push them forward as kind of the fabric that holds this conference together. Like, when you look at the ACC, it's easy to kind of write them off as not necessarily having a collective culture. And no, we don't have the same one that, like, maybe the Big Ten and SEC do, but I would say the ACC's collective culture is more digital and also stronger just in general in terms of common fabric and common ground and things that the universities share. You know, a lot of them are academically focused. There's a bunch of private schools there. Like, we send a lot of our alums to similar areas. Like, there are a lot of similarities there, and there's a lot to kind of bank on and really hone in on and celebrate and push, because that's really what's going to get people tuned in, is feeling like they're invested in something. At least for me, like, that's why I watch, at least at its height, I've watched a lot of ESPNU over the years. They feel like it's community and it's a conversation that I feel involved in and invested in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. It'll be fascinating to see how they handle it. It's been a little disconcerting that we haven't heard, like, that many specifics heading in, especially as we near when this launch is supposed to happen. But ultimately, I think, you know, it'll probably be a reasonable facsimile of what we've seen with the SEC network, with hopefully, you know, as we grow out, we'll see something a little more interesting, especially with the student involvement.
Totally. All right. I think that's good for Syracuse and ACC-related stuff. Why don't we move on a little bit of beer? Dan, what have you been drinking?
Okay, so I actually have had a bunch of things since last time we spoke. Most of it was, I'm trying to remember the date. We were on the 18th last time, right?
Yes.
Okay, so a couple different things. So on Monday, I was out with a couple of friends at the Astoria Beer and Cheese in Queens, which is a great beer shop and cheese shop, as you can imagine from the name. I had a flight of a couple of things I have on tap. They usually get some pretty unique, rare things there. I had a coconut almond abduction from Pipeworks Brewing, very, very dark, super coconutty, really strong alcohol, I think, as well. It's over 10%. Really nice, kind of velvety flavor for an Imperial Stout. That's from Pipeworks. Brewing. So that was nice. I'm definitely like, I feel like I've definitely gotten more into dark beers. I'll only have like one or two at a time, but I've definitely opened up to those. I've had a once, twice, three times a whale from Finback Brewing, which was a very, very extremely hazy double IPA. Like if you look at it, it actually looks like orange juice, and 8.2%. But actually, surprisingly, based on like how hazy it was and how strong it was, the hops were like pretty gentle. I'm not sure what the actual hops they use in it are. I'm sure it's not too hard to find it, figure it out. But just really, really drinkable for what it was. So that was a surprise. I had a Burst from Fox Farm Brewing, which is in Salem, Connecticut, which I had not heard of before, and neither had the people at Astoria Beer and Cheese until they got this one on tap, which is a really nice, just kind of standard American IPA, nothing too crazy, just really well-balanced, solid effort. And I think it's like the first thing they've really kind of sent around, so it's a nice introduction, I think. I had, later on we went to John Brown Smokehouse, which is in, also in Queens, has a really good beer menu. I had a Bushwick Zombie from Kings County Brewers Collective, one of the better breweries here in New York, which is a raspberry peach sour. Really, really good. Very, very, like, you know, very flavorful fruity sour. So you know what you're getting into. It's like bright, bright red, but very, very drinkable and delicious. I had a Combining Forms from Finback there, which is another strong IPA. I think I've had that one before and mentioned it. I had a Citra Bravo Mango later at Fifth Harmer Brewing Company, which was a nice IPA, and a couple other things from them. And the only other one that I had, which wasn't among my favorites of the day, was the Post Shift Pilsner by Jack's Abbey. But I do bring it up because on Mondays, John Brown has this for $2, which is basically like unheard of in the city. So if you're around Queens and you want a $2 pint, like that's your shot.
Very nice. You heard it from the man. He carried the banner this week. I did some stuff, but mine's going to be a lot more boring than that. I was out in Palm Springs, I mentioned last week. So I had a Bavik Super Pils. I had a bunch of Lagunitas Little Something Easy. I had a Stone Ripper from Stone. And then I had some house beer, and that was really it. Tried to keep it light. It was like 118 degrees. I had no interest in drinking anything heavier than like a 5.5% pale ale.
That's fair. I should plug it again since we are getting close.
Yeah, go for it.
August 16th, the Syracuse Alumni Club of Westchester County / Fairfield County is hosting a beer tasting and Syracuse football talk with yours truly at Broken Bow Brewing in Tuckahoe, New York, which is just north of the city. It says it's running from 6 to 8:30 p.m. I will be there talking SU football and drinking beers. So there's more information through the Alumni Association. I'm sure we can toss another link. I know we did a couple weeks ago, but would love to see everyone there. So shoot me a line if you need any more information, but I'll be there, and it should be a pretty good time.
Ask Tulane questions. You can devolve this thing into the podcast without
me. If you bring me a piece of Tulane gear, I'll buy you a beer.
There it is. All right. Now we shift actually to Tulane's old conference, the SEC.
People forget that. Shout out to Georgia Tech and Suwannee.
I'm sure some other people were in there too, but I know those guys in particular. The SEC is pretty much what it always is. Let's start with like the mess around nonsense teams, just because I feel like, I don't know. I don't need to get into like the soul sucking hellscape that is Alabama football and how boring it is. We'll get there eventually, I swear. There's a bunch of teams with new coaches. Arkansas in particular brings in a new coach in Chad Morris, who did pretty well at SMU. I'm interested in the fit here. I think it's going to go poorly this year, but you're going to see the pieces coming together for the Razorbacks.
Yeah, I like the Chad Morris hire. It was kind of, it wasn't like out of total nowhere, but it wasn't super expected. Obviously, they had a long dalliance with Dust Malzahn, who's a native son. Ultimately, he used them to get Auburn to give him a giant deal. So, you know, kudos to him. Morris was, I think he's a relatively inspired hire. It takes Arkansas in a slightly different direction. Mostly interested to see in the future how the recruiting goes, because he's a Texas guy through and through. And I think there is room for a couple other schools that aren't A&M and LSU to a lesser extent to get more involved in Texas. And Arkansas is obviously a more natural fit since they are a former Big 12 member. I think they have Devon Whaley, who is a star running back, who is returning. He'll be very good the whole right off the bat. I'm interested to see how much of a transition there is on offense, because even late in the Brett Bielema tenure, they started opening things up more on offense from like the old Wisconsin ground and pound that he was trying to institute there in the beginning. So I think it might be a little less of a transition on that side of the ball than you know, is obvious, but still, like, Morris takes things to another level with his style of Texas spread. So it's a nice hire. I do think they're going to be fighting an uphill battle at first, but overall, I like this move.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's just a product of division. Like, you're in the SEC West. It's similar at this point to, like, you know, the ACC Atlantic, too, where, like, you can improve, and you might not notice it for a couple of years, if only because of how good everybody else is. So, good luck, Hogs. I would say that, you know, they're probably not the worst team of those that change coaches this offseason, though. I think that honor goes to Tennessee. I don't really know what they've got on this team right now. I think there's still plenty of talent. I just don't know if it's talent that gets them to a bowl game, especially when there's, like, a lot of questions already around Jeremy Pruitt.
Yeah, this was probably my least favorite hire of this group of SEC hires. Clearly, like, Kirby Smart obviously has kind of bucked the trend of Saban assistants not living up, at least as of now. I tend to believe that's going to continue. He seems to be doing everything about as well as possible.
Yeah.
The Pruitt hire is clearly like, hey, look what they just did. Let's go do that. And also, we're Alabama's rival, so let's just, like, poach their guy since they beat the hell out of us every year.
This is why the SEC is bad, because everybody's doing that.
Yeah, the problem is, like, their coaching search was such a disaster. I kind of get where you just settle on Pruitt. It seems like a guy who should have, like, a pretty high floor, but then every time we see these defensive coordinator hires, obviously Smart has worked out great, but, like, defensive coordinators just do not, on average, have as high a floor or a ceiling as offensive coordinator hires. And there's a reason, like, there are questions about his personality that have been raised publicly now during SEC media days, but also privately before. Like, there was a weird fallout with him and Jimbo Fisher at Florida State when he was there for 1 year and they won the title. He was out at Georgia pretty quickly, although he got hired by Alabama, so it's hard to really question that. But, like, he moved around a lot early on, except for when he was under Nick Saban. So it does raise questions about, you know, how he fits in with other coaches. Now he's a head coach, so that's less of an issue for him in terms of his own job sake for the next year or two. But I do wonder how he'll, like, build a staff and how he'll maintain, just based on what, you know, is out there about him. So, like, I kind of get why Tennessee did this after the whole Schiano thing, but it's not the most inspiring hire.
No, not at all. And you know, I still think it'll work out enough, if only because, you know, Tennessee fans are at least going to give this a year. It's probably just a year before they start getting ornery. I think a lot of it might even depend on how Vandy does. Like, if Vandy's kind of treading water under Derek Mason, maybe they're a little bit more calm about it. If Vandy's
able, can't lose to Vandy again. They can, because they're not going to fire Pruitt after a year, but unless something crazy happens. But
if they lose by more than 18, maybe they do.
That if they go 3-9 and lose by 19 points to Vandy, then maybe, yeah, then maybe we have some questions.
Real talk, I got the Vols at 4-8.
I don't have the schedule in front of me. Who do they have at a conference?
West Virginia, neutral site, that's a loss. They got ETSU and UTEP, those are wins.
Yep.
You got road games at Georgia, Auburn, South Carolina. Those are three losses right there.
Plus you have the Alabama crossover.
Yeah, you got the Alabama crossover. You host Florida. You got Kentucky and Missouri in November, and then you're at Vandy to close.
I might even do 3-9.
That was my original. I thought 3-9. I'm like, oh god. Like,
I feel like they could steal another one, but, like,
sure.
They're just starting from a lower place in a lot of these teams. I think they'll beat Vandy. I think they'll obviously win the two easier non-conference games, the ETSU and I mean, they happen to catch UTEP at, like, the best possible time. I guess last year was probably the best possible time.
Well, any year is the best possible time at UTEP.
Right. Yeah, it could be ugly, especially because, like, the quarterback situation is just not great. Keller Crist, like, was okay occasionally at Stanford, but he's very boring. Jared Garantano had some moments last year. He's, like, the guy that I think the team probably hopes wins the job, and the fans like ideally want to win the job since he's the homegrown talent,
right,
New Jersey. Homegrown as in he was recruited, he's from Jersey, so it's not exactly Knoxville. But he had some just really rough outings through his first couple of years, so yeah, just not a lot there. They do get Juwan Jennings back, who was by far their best offensive playmaker on the roster. He's the guy who caught the Hail Mary in UGA a couple of years ago. And he was suspended, I think, all of last year, or most of last year at least.
I believe so,
that's,
yeah.
That's a big help. And defensively, they should have some stuff going for them. You know, it's actually funny. I think, like, every single – I was going through previews. Obviously, Bill C's aren't out yet, so I was going through a couple different sites. But I think almost every single protein change in the SEC, which is, like, half the lead this year, ended up with a 4-3 to 3-4 or opposite switch.
I feel
almost
like
every single DC move, almost every single new defensive coordinator switched the defensive system from the church before.
Such a weird.
Which just like, that's just, I think that's just like, just strange. Because I have it noted for a bunch here. I have it noted for Tennessee. I have it noted for, I think, I don't remember if Ole Miss was running the 4-2-5 last year or if they just are this year. Mississippi State is switching from a 3-4 to a 4-3. I think Florida switches to a 3-4 with Brantham. I think Arkansas switching to a 4-3 with Chavis. So that's at least like 5 or 6.
Not about you, but I hate the 3-4.
I don't mind the 3-4. I think you just really, really need the right players right for it.
Which, like, when Wake Forest ran it, or does Wake Forest still run it? Because I feel like Wake Forest like has run a 3-4 in the past. They did it when, like, Nikita Whitlock was there.
Yeah, which you had a really good nose tackle, which right, is not a super abundant thing. Like, Alabama can do it because Alabama always has like three all SEC linebackers and their entire front defensive line. You know, they'll have 4 or 5 like all SEC level talents for three spots.
Right.
So yeah, when you can recruit that kind of talent, you can do it. The problem is like A, getting like the right size defensive linemen, and also three defensive linemen who can play that scheme effectively at the college level is very, very difficult. NFL is a little more manageable.
Sure. Out of all the new hires, I think there's probably two that everybody will point to, and I'm curious to see what side of the aisle you fall on here. Probably Florida getting Dan Mullen, or Mississippi State getting Joe Moorhead. I'm of the opinion that Moorhead is a great fit for Mississippi State, aside from the like non-geographic fit. I think the offense is a great fit for what they have with Fitzpatrick. I think that in general, like, Mississippi State lately has been able, starting with Mullen and probably Moorhead will be able to do this too, has been able to get the level of playmaker needed to run that type of offense. So I'm really excited about it. I know we talked about Moorhead a little bit last week, just in terms of like, is there going to be a drop off with Penn State's offense? But yeah, I'm excited about what Mississippi State can do this year. I think they can honestly contend for the SEC West. That's not to slight Alabama, who we'll get to, because I think Alabama is probably the top team in the nation. But like, if ever Mississippi State was going to be able to pull an upset there, this might be the year.
Yeah, Mississippi State should have. It's always tough when there's a coaching change, and while I think there are enough similarities between the Mullen and the Moorhead schemes, where I don't think there should be a huge drop off in terms of the installation. You know, you never quite know how these things are going to go. I think it's a very inspired hire. It's not an obvious one by any means. I think it kind of came out of nowhere too.
It was like very like, efficient, very like they. I mean, they did know Mullen was leaving for like a long time, I feel.
Yeah, it just like it, like you look at the Tennessee hire was like the most like bland SEC hire possible. And if you're Tennessee, like you can't really get away with that because Tennessee has been bad for a while now. Mississippi State definitely can't get away with that because, you know, on paper, they could be one of the two or three worst programs in the conference. So to go and get Moorhead, who's a forward-thinking coach, he comes from a non-traditional SEC background, which, you know, I don't think that's like an advantage necessarily, but I don't think it's as much of a disadvantage as some people may think if the alternative is just getting, like, whatever defensive coach stood nearest to Nick Saban for 4 years. I think he's offensively just, like, he turned Penn State around. James Franklin might not still be there if not for Joe Moorhead. And that's not, like, exaggerating really at all. James Franklin was extremely close to the hot seat, at least in the fans 100%. And media's mind. And then midway through that year, a couple years ago...
An Ohio State game.
Yes, the Ohio State game. Moorhead's offense really took a turn. And since then, they've been dynamite now. You know, we talked about them last week. If he can do somewhat similar things... at Mississippi State, they'll be in very good shape for at least this year, because Fitzgerald is one of the best quarterbacks in the conference, probably top three, depends on what happens with Alabama. They bring back four or five offensive linemen. They bring back their 1,000-yard rusher, Aris Williams. Defense, I have some questions about because of Bob Shoup. He's had a weird last couple of years, and they've been completely unable to retain, even with Mullen there for so long. I think this is their fifth defensive coordinator in as many years, which is weird.
Well, last year didn't they just trade with Louisville, which is a terrible idea?
They got Grantham, right? And then they sent out...
what's his face?
Yes.
Who was bad?
Who was bad. And then Grantham went to Florida with Mullen. So they have Bob Shoup, who was at Tennessee most recently. It did not go very well for 2 years. Before that, he was at Penn State, and it did go pretty well. And before that, he was at Vanderbilt with Franklin, and that was pretty good, too. So last time, I mean, I think it really depends on what you're getting there. And obviously, Tennessee's issues were far beyond just the defense. So if Shoup can be what he was at Vandy and at Penn State, they're in pretty good shape. If he's what he was at Tennessee, then it's a little shakier. But I think it's probably not the craziest risk, especially because this is going to be a very offensive-geared club.
Yeah, I buy it. And honestly, like looking at the schedule, I mean, they have Florida and Auburn back-to-back. But Florida, Auburn, LSU, and A&M, four straight weeks.
They're going to be fired up for that Florida game.
They are going to be fired up for that.
Actually, I don't think anyone really blames Mullen for leaving, but no. Still.
Yeah,
still,
they definitely
those players will be fired up.
There is a gap between there's Florida, Auburn, both at home. Then there's a bye, and then it's at LSU and Texas A&M at home. To be honest, like, if you're going to have a stretch like that, three out of four at home and a bye in there is actually pretty good. I would take that. Yeah, I'd take that going away. Back end's actually all right. You get La Tech at Alabama, Arkansas at Ole Miss. Like, you could easily go 3-4 in the 3 out of 4 in there.
My one concern for Mississippi State is if they only win 8 games in year one. I hope for Moorhead's sake that their fan base isn't going to be really disappointed, because I think if you're Mississippi State in the SEC West, like, you have to just take 8 win years when you can get them. I know Mullen got them pretty cozy, but like, that should always be a pretty decent year, especially year one under a coach. Now, the ceiling, I think, is to probably finish second in the division and to maybe win like 10 games. And if they don't get there, I hope they don't freak out.
I feel like they'd be all right if they went 9-3 and their only losses were to Auburn and Alabama. I feel like they could live through it.
Yeah, I think that would be a great year for them.
Yeah, because like, when you have Fitzgerald, Aris Williams, like, those are two guys that like are, you know, all conference talents. I think that the two of them alone, you bring back, you know, four or five starters in the line, like, this offense should be fine. They do have the talent to be able to compete. So I'd say if they can go 9-3 or even go 10-2 and have the two losses be Auburn and Alabama, I think that's pretty legit. It just, to me, like, yeah, I am curious to see like how this goes. I almost think for them, like, it might be better to go 9-3 this year versus go 10-2 or 11-1, maybe narrowly lose the division. And then after Fitzgerald and Williams leave, then there's a little bit of come back to earth. And then suddenly, like, Mullen's dealing with questions in year two when they only quote-unquote, go 8-4.
Yeah, I buy it. Then the question becomes, like, what does recruiting look like? And that's a legitimate question. I think I don't know the full background of his full staff. I assume he has some SEC guys. I mean, Shoup obviously has SEC experience.
He kept some Mississippi guys around.
That's smart. So the recruiting is going to be interesting, I think. He's been so malleable in his career. Like, he made a pretty non-traditional step, going from the Fordham head coaching job to the Penn State OC job. Ended up being brilliant. He has an SEC job 2 years later, but I think he's adjustable enough where he'll be okay. And also, like, if he's picked up anything from Franklin, I'm sure it's recruiting, because that James Franklin is nuts at recruiting. And I still don't think he's a great game coach, but you can really make up for it by being an ace recruiter, and he is. So, I mean, if he's picked up, like, anything that James Franklin was putting down for a couple of years at Penn State, like, I wouldn't be too worried.
Also, keep in mind, like, it's not like Mullen's a local either.
No, that's true. Mullen's a
Northeast, yeah.
As well.
Yeah, yeah.
He's from, what, New Hampshire?
Yeah, he's like, he walked around in boat shoes all day.
Yeah, Brandon, he was at Florida before, so he had, right, like, a little bit more SEC experience, but Yeah, you definitely do not have to. I mean, like, Nick Saban's from West Virginia. He's not a North. West Virginia, despite what, you know, it seems like, is in the Northeast generally.
It's Appalachia. Like,
it's, yeah. It's not the South, though. So, even if it has some, you know, more
Southernish tendencies.
Yes. It's still not the same. Like, I don't think a lot of West Virginians are going to be going down to Alabama, and Alabamans are going to be, you know, telling them they're home, at least beyond, like, Southern charm. But you don't have to be from the South to succeed in the SEC. Like, that's just definitely not the case. Right. Urban Meyer, same thing. Like, it's been proven time and time again. If you're a good coach, you can kind of win wherever.
This is true. So what do you think the pecking order is at the top of this conference as we kind of transition to the top part of it? I think for me, I've got Alabama 1, Georgia 2, Auburn 3, and Mississippi State 4. I'm intrigued by the Aggies just because of Jimbo's arrival, but I don't think that's going to go as well in the early going as I think people would prefer it did, or maybe you're like thinking it will, just because the fit for the talent there isn't necessarily easy.
Yeah, I'm not buying the Aggies this year. I think Trevion Williams helps a lot. He's really good. I'm not a huge Nick Starkel fan or a Kellen Mond fan, so I don't know how that quarterback situation is going to play out, and I think their offensive line still leaves a lot to be desired. You're welcome for taking your probable starting left tackle. I'm not buying A&M. I think that top four is probably what I would do. It's just, I mean, Alabama, Georgia, just talent-wise, are very far ahead. I feel like Auburn's close. Auburn's quite good, and I'm pretty bullish on Jarrett Stidham at quarterback. I think they have some of their surrounding talent. You know, there might be some holes there, but they're quite talented as well. Mississippi State 4 is interesting. I'm rooting for them. I think not to make this a whole Mississippi State podcast, although they might be the most interesting team in this conference, but I could totally buy it. The other two, I think, are quiet and might make a push to finish second in the East. I think South Carolina and Mizzou are both intriguing.
I'd go with South Carolina or Kentucky there.
Kentucky, the quarterback thing, scares me.
It scares me, but at the same time, Mizzou, I'm still iffy about the defense and the fact that Heupel's gone at Missouri. I mean, Locke's still there, so obviously, like, he's...
Are you not looking forward to the Derek Dooley grand return to the SEC?
Listen, I like, until Heupel showed up and started installing, like, a goddamn air raid at Missouri, like, Odom looked like he was going to lose the job in year one. So
yeah, and I think that's why... I think Missouri is probably the highest ceiling, lowest floor. Right. I think there's the biggest range. Not the highest ceiling, obviously, but I think the biggest range between, like, best possible, worst possible seasons is probably at Missouri in this conference.
I buy that.
Because the offense, if it's like it was in the last half of last year, they started 1-5 and ended up making a bowl, so they did a reverse Syracuse. If the offense, like, holds on to, like, some of what it was down the stretch last year under with Heupel, who is obviously at UCF now, they're in good shape. I think the defense is pretty experienced, so it wasn't good last year, but it got better. And Odom was a good defensive coordinator, so you would think he'd be able to fit something. Obviously, we know well that doesn't always play out, but
high know, pit.
In some situations. High pit, high us.
Yeah, well, I figured I'd bury the other one first.
That's fair. Carolina... South Carolina, sorry, this is an ACC podcast. South Carolina.
And you're with a North Carolina fan, obviously.
Right. Jake Bentley is probably also in contention for, you know, one of the top three or four quarterbacks in the conference. They will get Debo Samuel back, who's one of the better skill position players in the conference. Their offensive, like, between them and LSU, can we get more interesting offensive coordinator hires, please? They both promoted internally. And, like, I get that it's not fair to blame, like, the new guys for the old OC, but, like, McClendon at South Carolina has never been an offensive coordinator before. He takes over for Roper, who was pretty awful at getting the ball in the end zone for 2 years. Obviously, last year, things bottomed out when Samuel got hurt. LSU promoted their tight end coach, whose name, where is it? I have it written down. Steve Ensminger, who I had never heard of until last year after the Matt Canada hire turned into a disaster.
It's just uninspired. It's
yeah. You would think that if anyone would go out and just try to get like a proven like you're LSU. You have some resources. And also, you're the legendary coach right before you got fired because he could not field an offense and was not bringing the offense into the 21st century.
So what do you do?
And now, so what do you do? And I don't blame him for Matt Canada not really working out. Clearly, there was just some kind of clash there, and just, the fit wasn't right. So, you know, it was 1 year, whatever. Like, you couldn't do better than hiring the tight end coach?
LSU scares me right now, like, as a program.
They could be pretty bad.
Like, they might be bad, and, like, I just don't really know what's going on there right now.
I think people are underplaying Coach O maybe being in trouble.
Well, I think Coach O's in trouble. I think my big problem with LSU right now is that, like, did Les Miles fool everyone into thinking they were blue blood? Because it seems like they can't necessarily attract the talent coaching-wise. And, like, I don't think that should be the case. And I, as mentioned numerous times, like, of all the teams at the top of the SEC, like, I'm fine with LSU winning over most of them. It's just, I find it odd that they've struggled to really get proper coaching talent in the door, other than, you know, Aranda on the defensive side of the ball.
Aranda proves that they'll pay for it because he's making an absurd amount. I think he has a $10 million deal over 4 years for a coordinator, which is insane.
Yep.
So they'll pay for it, which is always a question with LSU because of the actual economic situation in that state with regard to public education.
True.
I think part of it's that Coach O is taking less than your average SEC coach, so that helps. And I don't really mind. I didn't mind Coach O higher. I was listening to something today in preparation here where it was like they compared it to, like, on paper, the Dabo Swinney hire, where, you know, he oversees everything, he's enthusiastic, he recruits, and then he just brings in top-level coordinator talent. And that's exactly what Dabo did with Morris, Chad Morris at first, who is now, we talked about, at Arkansas, and Brett Venables, who could be a head coach if he really wants to be. That's a question for him. And Venables is still there, and they've just, you know, they've cycled through offensive coordinators, and they've all worked out pretty well. I get that model. It makes sense, considering Coach O's recruiting prowess and him being a Louisiana guy. But he just... They're coming from such a high place to where they were competing for national titles under Les Miles, and I didn't mind them moving on from Les when they did because things had clearly gotten stale. But to the Orgeron tenure is very much an extension of the Miles tenure, and that means he's not going to get the same type of rope that a fresh new hire would get. And that's not totally unfair, especially if he's going to do the same things that got Miles in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it was the same thing that we said about, I mean, in different situations, same thing we said about Schaefer. Is your continuity higher? You don't necessarily get the same rope. You're supposed to be kind of keeping the Marone ship afloat, and instead you did the exact opposite. So yeah, I think that, you know, you're right on there that that Orgeron probably has to prove something. I think eight's probably the best they're gonna do, but I don't know if that's good enough.
It depends on what the eight are. Like, if they pull a big upset, if they beat Alabama, I think he's fine. If they beat Auburn, I think they're probably fine. If they just tread water and it's eight, but it's like the same eight that they've been getting, then I don't know. I think with eight, they would probably still keep O around, but there'd be a mandate to, like, they'd have to make an outside offensive coordinator hire, and I think there'd be a lot of pressure on the recruiting class. I'm not sure where their ranking is now, but I know it hasn't been as good as it was under Miles the last couple of years, which is why you keep Coach O. You don't get fired over a recruiting class, but I think if they were to bring in something outside the top 10, there'd be a lot of heat going into next year. So I think odds are he's still there, but if they only win six or seven games, like, it'd be pretty hard to imagine him sticking around unless there was a giant upset in there.
Yeah, I'd have to agree there. So I guess directing focus kind of to the top two teams here before we wrap up. Do you feel like Alabama is a better team than Georgia? Because obviously that national title game didn't necessarily solve that question for us, given how close it was, how it went into overtime, how it seemed like Georgia did have Alabama figured out for some time at least.
I think last year you could argue, based on the title game, I think you could argue that Georgia was right there with Bama. Both teams lose a lot. I think Georgia probably loses a little more, and I think you just have to trust Alabama a little more. So it's tough. I think it's still very close. I would lean Bama. But a lot of it on both sides really depends on the quarterback situation, which Georgia obviously has a starter, but I don't think things are as obvious there as they may seem. I think Jake Fromm will start all year, but I'm interested to see what Jake Fromm looks like without Nick Chubb and Sony Michel. And Alabama, I think, will probably do the chief quarterback thing for a while. But ultimately, I think it's Tua Tagovailoa's job.
Well, I think, you know, Alabama also gets the benefit. I'm looking at both schedules right now. Both teams really get the benefit of not having to, like, Georgia has South Carolina week two on the road. But other than that, like, they do get to kind of ease into things, like, until they get at LSU on October 13th. Alabama, on the other hand, like, almost all their manageable games, like, they don't really, their season comes down to three games. They're all in November.
And that's when you do not want to play Alabama.
Also true. November 3rd at LSU, November 10th, Mississippi State at home, and then Auburn to close the season. But that's really it. Like, Alabama should be able to run out to 8-0, even 9-0, because I don't think LSU compete with them right now. But this Alabama team is going to be a tank, but they're going to look like a tank in particular because of just how the schedule is designed. I think no matter who's a quarterback, like, they should be well protected with 4 out of 5 returning on this line of NFL caliber players. Obviously have, you know, your usual, you know, huge guys. Matt Womack is phenomenal. I think the biggest questions, as always with Alabama, are going to be how you turn over that defense, and most of the team's gone, but because of how much time they have in garbage time, everybody on the two deep is getting, you know, 8 to 10 games of action. So I think that's obviously an advantage right now for Alabama, and it's one that Georgia, if they compete recruiting-wise at the same level they have been over the last couple of years, and especially this past season when they had the number one class, like, you know, then Georgia can start enjoying the same spoils. I think they're just like a year or two away from that same level of just elite depth.
Yeah, I'd say the one thing that does help is that, like, Mark Richt wasn't, like, not recruiting well there. It's just obviously Smart's taking things to another level. So there's still, like, plenty of talent on the roster. It's just the top talent is all freshmen and sophomores.
Yeah.
Because Georgia did lose 8 of 11 starters from that defense, which was really nasty. Alabama loses a lot as well. I don't think it's quite as much, but
I think it might be more. It doesn't matter because
it might be more in terms of their starters.
Yeah.
I think their secondary is basically all new. I think they have more depth pieces with experience in the front seven, even if it's not starting pieces.
True.
And Alabama always has those, like they just always have such a glut of players, even ones that we might not know about because they, you know, played sparingly last year and are kind of ready to come in bid roles. I think I just also trust the Alabama offense more this year, and I think especially once Tua takes over full time, which I fully expect.
Yeah.
I think the downfield passing game will be something to be reckoned with, as we saw in the national championship. Obviously, Calvin Ridley's gone, but Jerry Jeudy should be pretty good. Devontae Smith caught the big national championship touchdown. He's back. And then where Georgia loses their 2-star running backs, Alabama has, I think, 3 or 4 guys with experience coming back. Damian Harris is a 1,000-yard rusher, less flashy than your normal star Alabama running back, but still very effective. And then Najee Harris, who was, I think, the number 1 or 2 recruit in the country a couple years last year, depending on the site you went to.
Right.
He really didn't have a huge impact during the season. And then people have kind of, because obviously the storyline of the title game was the quarterback change. Najee Harris had a huge second half in the national title game and really came on. And he actually admitted he, like Tua, was kind of considering transferring back. He's a California kid as well. And then he had this huge breakout in the title game. So now he's back and will probably be close to a split with Damian Harris. So they just have a lot of weapons always, even when it doesn't, like, necessarily seem like they do. They just always have so much talent. So I definitely lean Alabama, although a lot of it's just that Georgia is youth and a little bit more unknown, but I also think Georgia's still clearly the best team in the SEC East, and by the time these two teams might match up in the SEC Championship, both will, you know, the experience thing will be largely, like, a non-factor, because, you know, by the time you get to November, your freshmen can be veterans if they need to be.
Totally. So I'm assuming we're both Alabama, Georgia in the title game, and
yeah.
Giving Alabama the win?
I'm giving Alabama the win.
Yeah, I'll do the same begrudgingly.
Really, I'd probably root for Georgia. I think there's a very good chance that Georgia's positioned itself to be the post-Saban superpower. But I think Alabama still has Saban.
I buy that a lot.
Actually, I know that. I know that for a fact.
I also think Georgia's probably undefeated going into that game.
Yeah, the South Carolina game, to be tricky, I think they're probably thrilled about it. Actually, I know. I've talked to fans. They're thrilled about getting Georgia when they do, just because there is so much inexperience. But I still would take Georgia in that game.
Yeah, I think they probably undefeated. I think Alabama could drop one to Auburn or Mississippi State, but it's not really going to matter. I'm very curious to see if a Pac-12 team can kind of rise above, or Oklahoma can, you know, figure it out post Baker Mayfield, because honestly, we're probably setting ourselves up for yet another playoff with two SEC teams.
It is certainly possible, unless you know, if we had a similar situation and Alabama was one loss and Georgia was undefeated, unless like Alabama absolutely smoked Georgia, like you could easily see it. If it was a close game, I think both would probably get through.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you look at the Pac-12, and we'll get there next week. There's not necessarily like a team that looks ready to dominate, especially win-loss-wise. And then Big 12, we've already discussed, like, everyone's kind of discounting Baker Mayfield effect. Like, if Oklahoma goes 10-2, I mean, they're the most talented team in that conference, but, like, they go 10-2, or West Virginia even goes 11-1, like, there's just not... I'd be very concerned if I was the other conferences that you're looking at a two-headed monster for the foreseeable future between Georgia and Alabama.
Yeah, especially if Georgia's going to continue to recruit. Like, Alabama for 2019 is so far ahead of everyone else, but Georgia finally, like, broke their crazy streak of recruiting national championships, quote-unquote, last year, and they're, I think, 1-2 right now. I think Alabama has 19 blue chips already in the mill for 2019. They have 18 four-star kids and only one five-star.
So more than Syracuse has had since the recruiting era started.
Yes, 100%. And like, I think that's like probably 9 more than any other team has.
Christ.
So yeah, I think Alabama's gonna be okay, and Georgia is doing fine as well. They're both in really, really good shape.
Fair enough. On that demure note, Dan, anything else you want to talk about before we hop off for the week?
No, looking forward to these last couple of Boeheim's Army games. Hopefully they're not the last couple. I think there's a third weekend, right?
There is.
Yeah, so it's like the NCAA. Yeah, so hopefully not the last couple. Hopefully the middle couple of Boeheim's Army games.
Agreed. They're down in Atlanta starting Saturday. Everyone should tune in. It's on ESPN. But that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast for what's been over 70 minutes this week. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and go Orange.
Go Orange.